creating the spaces in your life to address mental health. And that would might mean for many people having therapy as a place to sort of talk about it and talk it through and sort of process that stuff. But one of the most important things, just like dentists want us to come in every six months for cleanings and checkups, it should be no different than in mental health. If people are going to roll up to a dentist's office every 6 months, they should be rolling up to a shrink's office every 6 months for a checkup as well.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Secrets to Success. In today's episode, I have a licensed clinical psychologist, a best-selling author, a professor of psychology, and distinguished international speaker, that is Dr. Romani. Her work has been featured on TEDx a numerous amount of times in Red Table Talk with both Jada and Will Smith as he spoke about his Fresh Prince of Bel-Air reunion. Also, The Today Show and a wide range of other media platforms. I feel that her work is really important, especially in the field of dentistry, where mental health is such a big topic. Dr. Romani, thank you so much for your time. I appreciate having you here.
Thank you. I appreciate it too. Thank you.
So for everyone tuned in right now, would you please be able to give a background about yourself and why did you choose to go into narcissism as a speciality in psychology?
Yeah, so I've been a professor for over 20 years, coming on 22 years. I am a clinical psychologist. I've been licensed to practice since 1998. And I have, you know, I've written many scores of academic articles. And in 2008, 2009, I started working more in the media. One of the things I noticed was that some of the mental health stuff I was seeing in the media wasn't actually up to my standard. And I thought, well, instead of complaining about it, why not do something about it? And so I slowly started getting involved in that space. And that was actually before YouTube really existed. Blogging was slowly coming up. It was a little harder to create a platform, and I wasn't very good at it. I wasn't sort of a young person who was doing the whole social media thing. And so I sort of was in and out of the media space and doing work in all kinds of different, you know, places around governance in the field. But I also noticed that there are a lot of people out there who didn't have access to mental health services and probably wouldn't ever roll up to a therapist's office, but I also knew that they were going to need psychoeducation. And meaning that they just sort of education about mental health, mental illness, when you should consider talking to your physician or talking to a mental health practitioner, answering some of the basic questions. And over time, that has evolved into YouTube. And ironically, this is why I always say that people of a certain age should not be so arrogant as to not listen to younger people. It was younger people who said, listen, your books are great, but most people don't sit down and read long books. But what they will do is watch videos. And I said, I don't like doing videos. And they said, we get that you don't like videos. Will you give us a shot? Can we shoot a few? Let's see what happens. And that grew from a few thousand subscribers to we're probably close to 500,000 subscribers now. And so getting millions of hits a month and really changing people's understanding of this particular difficult pattern, narcissism, which I actually got into initially through my research. And interestingly, talking to a dentistry show is that it actually, in my research, it was originally focused on how people interacted in healthcare settings, how very difficult clients could actually upend everything. They would really be stressful for frontline staff like reception. They would be stressful for the first line of primary care, which were often sort of nurses, nurse practitioners, technician people. And then they'd even be stressful for the physicians. And I noticed that this group of sort of difficult clients were probably sucking a disproportionate amount of healthcare resources. My specific area of research at that point had been HIV and AIDS. So I was very focused on that particular patient population. And then that work expanded into my clinical work, where I saw more and more patients coming in who were really struggling with difficult relationships. And I thought, this is so interesting how little these folks know about how this difficult personality style in a spouse is impacting this marriage. And from there, it just sort of grew kind of gradually. So it was in response both to research and to clinical practice.
Wow, amazing. And I've seen your talks on TEDx, Red Table Talk, and I really feel like all of our listeners could benefit from your teachings. In terms of dentistry, dentistry is said to be the career with the highest suicide rate, and I think this may be due to a number of different reasons, from difficult patients to toxic work environments, difficult colleagues, and just bringing all of that stress back home as well. I can understand why that number is quite high. But if we could just tackle the root cause of it, starting from difficult, even anxious patients first, because sometimes automatically, before we've even had a chance to interact with the patient, they've already got negative feelings towards the dentist because, you know, they might have had a bad experience or so. So what do you think is the best way to approach patients to make sure that they're at ease and they can put their trust in us and develop a good relationship?
It's so interesting. After you and I originally were sort of corresponding, I went and tried to look at some of the literature on dentistry and suicide. And, you know, the data have been a little bit like sort of inconsistent, but there was definitely a trend towards probably a higher than expected rate of completed suicide in people who have backgrounds as dentists. And part of that was explained away by demographic factors, but part of it seemed to be inherent in the field. Whether it culminates in something as severe an outcome as suicide, or even in just a wide range of mental health outcomes, there's absolutely some unique aspects of dentistry in terms of the intersection with their patient populations. Many people are scared of the dentist. A lot of people don't want to go. So the question is, what can you in dentistry do to sort of work with patients who might already be coming in with a heightened sense of anxiety, or even a heightened sense of, I don't want to be doing this. I don't want to be bothered with this. I have to say that, you know, some of the dentistry practices I've seen have actually done a really nice job of creating a really pleasant experience. I mean, one of the most important things a dentistry practice could do is have really, really warm, well-trained frontline staff. In terms of whoever greets the patients, whoever interacts with them on the phone, and really, really seamless kinds of interfaces in terms of appointment scheduling via online or text message or whatever, making it as user-friendly as possible. People lose patience when they have to press a bunch of buttons and be on hold and wait a long time. So the more user-friendly the experience is, obviously that's going to bring down some of the pressure. I would say that beyond that, part of what the dentistry profession may also face is sort of a rebranding, right? Like, I think that the days of the whizzing dental drill, some of that is gone. I mean, obviously, dentistry practice has advanced to a place where a lot of the procedures that were once felt much more invasive and painful have really come a long way. But I still think people see that image of them as children being very scared to get a cavity filled in. So part of this also may be sort of how education and how it's portrayed and how it's talked about, and using platforms to sort of demystify sort of what dentistry is. I would also say that part of the problem, you know, that dentistry may face is around cost. When you separate a person and their money, you're going to get the worst of them. There's no two ways about it. And it's ironic how little people want to spend when it comes to their own health care. So they'll be willing to spend on luxury goods and expensive lunch and an expensive cup of coffee. But when it comes to their health care, any additional costs are really problematic. So I would say anything that sort of makes that conversation more transparent and more understandable. I have to say, in healthcare as a whole, one thing that a lot of people, and rightfully, react strongly to is feeling as though they get hit with a bill at the end after the work has been done. It's almost like someone fixing your car and saying, that's going to be $1,000. I said, if I knew it was going to be $1,000, I wouldn't have gotten my car fixed. And so that, I know, is something that I've heard actually in my own patient population. They've complained about dentistry, saying, I know how expensive it's going to be, so I'm not going to go. And then there's a resentment that builds up because they may actually need dental care, but they feel like there's an accessibility issue. That seems like an issue in the field, you know, that to create that kind of conversation. But ultimately, when you have a patient who's stressed, who's uncomfortable, and is having to succumb to a procedure, if that person already has a personality style or mental health issues that are already kind of tense, you're going to see a much more antagonistic patient. And that antagonism is what will then really take a toll on all individuals in a dental practice, from reception to dental hygiene to the dentist themselves. So I think that it's really understanding that this isn't just about one issue, but it's that it has to be viewed holistically, the discipline as a whole, the training of staff, the understanding of the stress the patient brings in. And above all else, it's also about training the staff. One of the things that many people fall, the sort of the unhealthy patterns that people fall into, especially when they work in healthcare, is to personalize the really agitated, angry responses of an unhappy patient. I feel so bad. This is my fault. When somebody is screaming and yelling and agitated, it's so important that we don't personalize that. It's coming at us and we're being attacked. But if somebody's attacking that strongly, it's typically not just about a mistake we may have made, but something about that other person's style. And they're screaming at everyone, not just you, but the person in the coffee shop and the waiter in the restaurant and the person they work with. This is what they do. And I think it's really, really important, even from a training perspective, for people to understand when someone's screaming at you, this is about them. There's a more appropriate way to state this. Don't internalize their rage as some sort of massive failing in yourself. And this can be doubly triggering for dentists and a dental office staff who may have their own histories of narcissistic relationships with parents, spouses. So coming to work and experiencing that rage from a patient can actually be really psychiatrically and psychologically destabilizing for the person who works in the dental office.
I definitely resonate with what you said when you say don't take things so personally. I know I've been guilty of that, and know some of my colleagues have as well. In terms of price then, how would you tackle that issue of cost with patients? In dentistry, we have a saying dentistry isn't expensive, neglect is. So it's the more and more you put something off, the more and more expensive it could become. Mm-hmm. So do you think it's always best to highlight that with our patients and always explain the cost of everything we do before we sit them down?
Personally, I think it is. And this is actually very much aligned with what we're even seeing in healthcare in general, is that this is almost like a nonpartisan issue. Everyone believes there should be more transparency in healthcare pricing. And I think many, many people, because it's healthcare, as much as people may neglect it, some people also go all in. Of course, I'll get the diagnostic test. And then they get a bill from their insurer saying, well, insurance only covered $100, so you're into us for $800. And then people might have said, I can't pay this bill. You know, there's nothing I can do. And the stress of not being able to pay the bill actually overwhelms possibly what the utility of that diagnostic test was. So it is, healthcare is the only business in the world where you're given a service and told what it costs later. Again, can you imagine going into a restaurant and saying, I'd like to order this, but we're not going to tell you how much this steak is until after you order it? It would be unheard of. I'm very transparent. I'll say, if you spend this much time with me, a 1 hour session costs this, each amount afterwards is prorated as such. There's no question. I don't say, well, and by the way, just wanted to let you know this, how much this session is. And they'll say, I had no idea. And so I do think that from a stress mitigation perspective for a certain proportion of patients, telling them ahead of time, these are the things we're going to do, and these are the costs involved. Personally, I can say that is actually what my dental office does. They'll do the diagnostic and say, in order to do this, this, and this, it's going to cost this and this and this. And sometimes they'll say, I can't afford X and Y, but I can afford C. And they're saying A and B are emergent. You've got to get those done. And say, okay, I can budget A and B, but I'm going to put off this other thing. It's like anything. People have budgets. And so I think that the more transparency on the front end, that's not to say that a difficult patient still won't get agitated. How dare you do this? This is highway robbery. You're never going to fully mitigate that. But I think that a subset of patients, their agitation could be managed by being very transparent on the front end and then working with the client in an honest way to prioritize what the care is. Some things are non-negotiable. If you don't get this, there's a risk of an abscess or an infection. Some things may be a little bit more cosmetic or sort of a higher end material or something like that to help people understand that. I think in that way, even the profession of dentistry also has to be aware that they have a privilege. They know. They're like, okay, this costs this much. You could get the lesser version for this much. That kind of transparency. I think, again, a significant subset of clients, you'd probably be able to manage some of the antagonism, but I think some folks are going to blow their stack no matter what you tell them.
Wow. Okay. And also, you said that, you know, to be able to calm the patient down from dental anxiety, it's important to have warm front of house staff that greet them and take them in. and everything as well. Okay, I think that's very important. Is there anything else you'd say that once they're in the dental chair, do you feel like, you know, is it body language? Is it the tone of voice? What is it the most important thing that we can do when someone's just scared of the drilling sound, just really tense in there before you inject them with anesthesia? Those type of patients who are just really tense, you know, sometimes it's really uncomfortable to do treatment on them because they keep stopping and you have to keep starting over again. What's the best way, in a psychological way, to tackle this?
The issue here is sort of that of anxious patients, right? That some people, just the thought of going to the dentist and being subjected to a dental procedure, they might even have anxieties for days before, certainly the night before. One thing a dental practice can do is even not just wait till they're in the chair, maybe even send them relaxation resources a week or two ahead. Could set them up with a meditation or a mindfulness app. You could send them sort of daily prompts if they choose. You can opt in of like different kinds of breathing exercises they could do. Maybe even things they could read, like almost work with the client ahead of time to normalize it, to say X percent of people have significant dental fear. You're not alone. Yeah. Once they're in the dental office, perhaps as they're sitting down and before maybe the practice staff has come in, maybe not so much of the bright, you know, operating room fluorescent lighting, but using more dimmed lighting, ensuring that the temperature is at a level that the patient finds comfortable, that the seating is also, you know, that's comfortable as well. Having something up that might entertain them. I have to say personally, my dentist literally has been playing the same videos for 20 years. If I have to watch one more video of an aerial view of Tuscany, I'm like, it's making me anxious just watching the same thing over and over again. We live in a time of so much on-demand media. If somebody had something up above them that they're watching that genuinely engaged them, maybe a library of movies or something like that, that could actually distract them in a more meaningful way than playing some sort of, you know, tired, you know, maybe what they have, or they have an ancient DVD system or something like that. Think about what could distract, and imagery distracts, especially imagery that's sort of fun, or maybe have a series of, like, it doesn't have to have endless media, but maybe like 10 very popular movies that are familiar. Because what you might find is what your patients would enjoy watching is a movie they've watched over and over and over again. I've nursed some hair salons. They always play the same kind of women-oriented movies over and over again with subtitles. Yeah. And it actually probably relaxes people to see a movie they've seen many times before, and they just kind of get lost in it, but they haven't watched it recently because it's something they've watched so many times. There's so many different ways to offer that kind of comfort. People don't want to watch videos on dental care and the latest in dental technology, or they don't want to watch best practices in dentistry while they're in a dental chair. So I would say really think the way a hair salon does in terms of how they actually put out entertainment. I would say then the next piece is communication. Is when the especially, I think it's usually a hygienist that might come in first. Tell people what you're going to do to them. Okay, I'm going to do this, then I'm going to do this, then I'm going to do this. Are you okay? Especially for people who are deeply anxious or tense. And frankly, even for people, and a dentist probably wouldn't know this, who, for example, have trauma histories. If you're working with a patient who has a history of trauma, knowing what's coming is really, really important. So to say how it's going to go is, I'm going to brush your teeth first, and we're going to use this, and it's going to sound like this, and you're going to rinse out your mouth, and you're literally kind of walking them through so there's no surprises, which really helps for someone who's anxious. Then the dentist is going to come in. I'm going to review your records with you, you know, at any given time in this. Can you know, you can ask me questions. Something else that often happens is that the dentist and the hygienist might be communicating in a way that's really mysterious to the patient. They'll be saying these numbers and these letters. It can often help a patient to be told, this number means this number tooth or whatever it means, and this means this. And what we're doing is we're going back and forth and we're just reviewing the record. So that way, a person sometimes, so much of what makes medical procedures feel anxiety producing is that the person doesn't know what's happening. But if somebody actually says, this is what I'm saying, it's no great mystery here, it can actually help soothe. Some patients are like, I don't care. You know, you can ask them, like, do you want us to do that? And then it's on the dental team to take the extra time to say, when I say this and this, we're talking about your rear molars and we're talking about previous cavities you've had. it could actually help soothe patients. So it's to think out, I think many times when we get sort of into our automatic way of doing things, we forget to sort of slow things down to meet people who are unfamiliar with what we're doing, where they are at. Some people say, I don't need this, but for somebody who's very anxious, that might help them a lot. And over time, what you might find then is that that with that level of attentiveness, there could be sort of a drop in anxiety. In addition, you may have people who have lots of questions they feel foolish asking, so they don't ask the question and they remain anxious. A classical example would be x-rays. Dental x-rays are often regularly taken. There are many patients out there who are quite anxious about being exposed to radiation. The standard answer is there's not much, don't worry about it. And so they don't say it. Anticipate, especially your anxious patients' questions, and say, just want to reassure you, I know a lot of people have questions about the radiation from x-rays. We're going to be putting this, you know, heavy apron on you, lead apron. This is how much you're being exposed to give you a comparison. This is how much you're composed to, you know, I don't know, exposed to, I should say, with a television or microwave, whatever your indices are.
Sure.
Some people might say, I don't care. I knew it was not an issue. But the patients who are anxious, who are afraid to ask, are often the ones who are now bottled up with anxiety because they don't want to look silly. Anticipate the silly and try to give them the answer so they can exhale and almost play it cool. Like, it's good to know that, but I didn't want to ask them that.
Sure. That's amazing. That's amazing. I think that's something we definitely could all learn from, because a lot of the time, because we take so many x-rays throughout the day, we sit the patient down in the chair, just say, it's not going to be harmful, it's just fine. But then we end up walking out the room to press the button.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. You walk out of the room, and there's so many people out there. For example, women who are of childbearing age may wonder, could this be accumulated exposure? Am I going to get cancer? You know, one thing that could even be useful is that as you take the person into the x-ray room and maybe let them sit there a moment, that you have an infographic about that. You know, that da-da-da-da-da-da-da, so the person can sort of read it, maybe in multiple languages, depending on your patient population. So a person can read that and say, oh, how nice, my questions have been answered. Healthcare providers, especially dentistry, always has to be reminded, patients often don't ask the questions, especially anxious patients. So there's a responsibility on the healthcare provider to anticipate those questions and provide information in an accessible way that could help soothe that anxiety.
Amazing. Thank you so much. That's really, really helpful. So moving on from patients then, I'm not sure if you're aware, but dentistry itself is a very competitive
work.
So I think across the world, it's probably true that, you know, coming into the workplace, I've just graduated recently. And once I step foot into the dental world, I can already see that there's a lot of competition. Everyone's always trying to be the best dentist, produce the best work to get, you know, all the patients. Even social media, it's great to display the work there, but a lot of dentists now competing with one another to get the most followers, get the most likes, get the most, you know, best cases and all. It's something that you don't really see in many other professions. Like, you know, even with medicine, with doctors and stuff, they're not as competitive as dentists are here in the UK. I'm not sure about America there.
It is quite competitive in the United States, yes.
With that as well, it puts on a lot of pressure for young people if we're not regularly posting, putting out our cases, keeping up to date with, you know, the next dentist that's always consistently producing content and all. How can we you know, deal with this pressure that's put up upon us, and, you know, deal with it, that we can still remain productive but at the same time still able to have a life as well?
It's very challenging in a profession like dentistry, which obviously has front-end investments that maybe other healthcare practitioners wouldn't have, in terms of especially if you're going to start an independent office or acquire another practice. The investment costs on the front end are high, which added to sort of dental school or undergraduate university costs can really be a massive amount of debt with which to start a career. And for people who may not come from family systems that can sort of give them money or other, you know, other sorts of beneficence that sort of help not, you know, so they don't have to get that debt. They might be viewing it as, I'm going to spend my whole career trying to pay this debt down. Yeah. And so I think that in any field, and I don't think it's limited to dentistry, but in any field that's competitive, there's always going to be a tremendous amount of stress associated with that. Part of it is realistic expectations. Some people might have gone into dentistry expecting a certain level of lifestyle. And now with all these costs, it's not sort of keeping pace. They're thinking, well, what I thought was going to happen for putting all this time and education in, I'm not really able to get. The other issue is that many people in professional school, graduate school, unless they're studying business, maybe law, they're not being taught to be entrepreneurs. Yes. And a big part of dentistry is entrepreneurship. Yes. It's how to think about, how do I advertise? How do I use social media? How do I use YouTube or whatever? People think, I did not go spend all these years in school to be competing with people who are putting makeup on in a video to be able to foster my practice. That's and the idea of hiring a publicist and some and paying someone to that then becomes one more line item on the top of a dental office, which is already so expensive to run. And the entire dental industry got completely hammered by the pandemic, you know, more than, you know, many others, because people got very anxious to go in for dentistry. Honestly, almost other than emergency dentistry, people became very reluctant. So there was that loss of income. I would say there's a couple of things. One is to turn to colleagues for support. Nobody's going through this alone. And one of the things that people who are very stressed, anxious, and depressed often happens automatically is they become very isolated. The assumption is, I'm the only one who's struggling like this. Everyone else has it all figured out. Look at their Instagram posts. Look at their flashy advertising. I'm the only one who's sort of struggling along in this sort of storefront and all of that. Mm-hmm. You're not the only one struggling. And the more there can be communities of support, and communities of support where it's not just about people sharing marketing advice, but really sharing about vulnerability. Dental conferences should be building and programming on things like burnout, depression, anxiety, real mental health issues that come from in any kind of solo practitioner business. Working alone can be hard. A lot of dentists are a practitioner with staff, but what they don't have is equal level colleagues that maybe they can complain to or get feedback from. The people who are working with them are sort of they're reporting to them. So it's not as much of a space where they can vent. And so creating those spaces virtually or otherwise where there can be an opportunity to vent also becomes important, just to feel like, okay, I'm not the only one going through this. What is a realistic expectation? And then it comes down to realistic expectations. That's one of the hardest, calls we have at this point in this time in history, where everybody's comparing themselves to everybody else on social media. There's always that one dentist who has, like, honestly has a glamour shot and a glamour practice and a glamour this, and you're comparing yourself to that thinking, I can't keep up with that. Yeah. And so this expectation is set up here. You feel like you're down here, and that gap between where the expectation is set and where you think you are really can contribute to significant distress. Having realistic expectations really means shutting down all that social media nonsense for a minute and sit down and really take a long, hard look at the numbers. Because ultimately, like I said, a big part of the dental training that's probably missing is real training on how to run a business, because it is actually a business. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, though, it is important for anyone in any profession, especially one that's very consumer facing, like dentistry, to do the things we recommend to anybody around mental health, which is ensuring you get enough sleep, ensuring that you're eating, you know, properly, well, and regularly, which can be hard in a dental practice, especially where everyone's wearing masks more than they ever have, to actually take the time to eat something adequately so you can keep going. It is about creating the spaces in your life to address mental health. And that would might mean for many people having therapy as a place to sort of talk about it and talk it through and sort of process that stuff. But one of the most important things, just like dentists want us to come in every six months for cleanings and checkups, it should be no different than in mental health. If people are going to roll up to a dentist's office every 6 months, they should be rolling up to a shrink's office every 6 months for a checkup as well. Nobody does that. And I honestly think that would be an aspirational standard, is that people, it's almost like a calibration. And if people who then were at higher risk could then go into more regular therapy, others would be like, hey, you look great. This is wonderful. Keep up on this, try this book, do that, and then send them on their way. Just like you would tell us to keep brushing and flossing. But it's that kind of piece about dentists should really seriously consider being in therapy, especially with a therapist who's informed on the stresses of healthcare practice. I also think, finally, it's important for anyone in the dentistry, as with any profession, is to know their limits. If they really feel like they're teetering towards burnout, a more severe intensification of their symptomatology, particularly if it veers into spaces like a person's using things like substances to cope, it's really, really important to consider maybe there needs to be a stepping away from your business, you know, taking a break, because then unlike many other fields, if a dentist is impaired, it could cause harm to somebody else. So it's a whole host of things that need to be considered. But more than anything else, the existential threat for many dentists is that I'm not doing this right. I need to be a celebrity and a dentist. Yeah. And that's obviously too high a calling for most. Some people might enjoy that kind of a world. But for some people, like, I just want to practice dentistry. Turn to your supports, get information from other people, have realistic expectations, work out a budget, you know, work potentially with a business manager who can give you sort of that tracking of cash flow and all of that. And that's probably a really important place for dentists to start with. And a lot of responsibility on universities that have dental schools. This kind of sort of life lesson curriculum should be built into dental training.
Yeah, definitely. I completely agree with you there. It's a module that's missing. Mm-hmm. That you could all benefit from. Mm-hmm. Moving on from that then, I'll be honest with you and say I'm guilty of this. Something I often do is I often take the pressures that I have from work bring them back home. So, you know, with my partner, sometimes I feel that sometimes when I'm at work, I'm doing my dentistry, but when I come back home, sometimes I'm actually have my own marketing company where I do advertising for different dentists. But I know other dentists themselves would often work during the day and then come back in the evening and start going on Instagram and start posting and start doing cases and stuff. And often our partners would be like, listen, you're not spending any time with us. What's more important? You know, what do you want to be remembered for? Your legacy is to do with dentistry, or is it being a good dad? Is it being a good husband? And of course, being a good husband and being a good dad, that's the most important thing for us. But I feel like in this competitive world of, you know, trying to be the best, trying to, like, you know, grow your practice, especially because most practices have taken a hit from COVID-19 when everyone's in lockdown, everyone was staying at home. Now we're able to open up our practices again, able to start seeing patients. When we're at work, we're working, but when we're back at home, there is no downtime. Like, you know, you really need to be doing it 24/7 if you want to be the best of the best. And sometimes I feel like our partners, our children, and family life in general can take a big hit from it. And at the end of the day, that is the most important thing rather than work.
So I would say that number one, that idea of not being able to have work balance and the idea of work sort of streaming into home life for anyone who is engaged in an entrepreneurial endeavor seems to be the new state of affairs. And I think maybe many dentists don't view themselves as entrepreneurs, they view themselves as dentists. And that there's sort of an expectation of a 9-to-5 life. I go, I see my patients, I come home and I have dinner with my family. And that once upon a time was what dentistry was.
Yeah.
Everybody is sort of in a 24/7 kind of a sort of a spinning wheel. But as you said, many people would want to think that they are devoting themselves to being a good partner, to being a good parent, but that requires the same intentionality as work. And so at some level, it has to be about communication. It's about, number one, that the partners in a relationship educate each other about what their work is about and what the expectations of that work is about, and almost revisit that conversation again every 6 months to sort of say, these things are changing at work. The ground is shifting under me. This is what's requiring more time. Just like with the patients who need to hear what's coming, the same thing has to happen with partners. It can't be a mystery. There's a tendency to say, I'm busy, I've got to get this done, instead of sitting down with a partner and saying, this is the nature of my practice now. And this is my cash flow. And in order to keep patients coming through here, these are the ways I have to market my practice, which means I have to do these things at night. And so I want to give you a realistic sense of what I need to do. And then perhaps together you can come. Then your partner might say, hey, I can help you with that. Or I know about that. Or now that I know about that, it doesn't feel like a mystery where the person's being brushed off. But there does have to be intentionality about the time that is set aside. It may be the sort of thing where a person says, listen, on the weekends, I'm going to have to work some hours in the morning. But as of this 2 o'clock, it is only family time until the end of the day. Everyone can plan around that. Maybe the others would do whatever they're doing, their errands or their schoolwork or whatever. Everyone kind of is now on the same page. And it's very clear that, however, now at this time, I'm going to give all of us our time and we're going to have this time together. But again, that can't be unilateral. It can't be the person who's the dentist in the family saying, this is when I'm free. The child might say, ah, actually, that's interesting because at 3 o'clock I have my soccer practice. And so the time you're free is not the time I'm free. So there has to be some flexibility. And this is just all about that kind of communication. Relationships only work when people talk about what's happening, and nobody's a mind reader. So there's no way somebody's partner is going to say, oh, I didn't realize dentistry means this, this, and this. You have to tell your partner and then have them take it in. They may even offer feedback and be able to be present with partner, with children. But at the end of the day, we can all pretend that our personal lives could be run like our careers. They can't. To be a parent, to be a partner, to be a human being, you have to be flexible. And sometimes those best laid plans, I'm going to work on Saturdays from 8 to 1, somebody gets sick, something goes wrong, there's an event, there's a this, there's a that. There has to be flexibility. And so I do tell people, you know, you need to come up with workflows and life flows that allow you to understand these are the things I need to get done. And I'm going to have to find some clever ways to do some of this. And again, the realistic expectations.
Thank you so much. It's really helpful. Moving forward then, one of the things that I know you're a specialist about is narcissism.
Yeah.
And I watched one of your YouTube videos and I wanted to ask you again, how can you just notice when someone is a narcissistic person or just not a nice person? What are the differences?
You know, the term narcissistic is probably sort of nested under the larger term of being a difficult person. All narcissistic people are difficult. Not all difficult people are narcissistic. And so narcissism really speaks to a more broad-based pattern of a lack of empathy or inconsistent empathy, entitlement, grandiosity, superficiality, validation and admiration seeking, difficulty regulating emotions, particularly around frustration, stress, or disappointment, often a sense of being very controlling, being very sensitive to criticism, being very egocentric. Those are the things that sort of fall under that territory of narcissism. Now, difficult people, as you can imagine, are all of those things, but they may veer into one more than the other. They may just simply be egocentric, but they may not be as grandiose or something like that. Whether the person's difficult or narcissistic, it's almost irrelevant. It's not going to be an easy encounter. These difficult people, these narcissistic people, take a tremendous toll on people's mental health and even physical health in the workplace. And I think a lot of it is sort of, oh, that's just how they are. Their bark is worse than their bite. They probably don't really mean it. There must be a way to figure out a workaround. There's not always. I think that what ends up happening is that the difficult person gets more and more and more and more enabled. People get more and more and more and more scared by them. And then before you know it, the only way to actually resolve the situation is sometimes to extract yourself entirely. And that could mean a person who's put years of work into a dental practice, feeling like they might have to sell off their portion of it or start again or move it someplace else and have to get new patients. That can feel devastating for someone. But it's not just that it would be dentist to dentist. It could also be with staff. It could be with a difficult hygienist or a difficult receptionist. One would say, well, that person doesn't have as much power. Difficult's difficult. And difficult employees almost always threaten litigation. In the United States, at least, difficult people will often threaten lawsuits when they don't get their way. And that threat will always hang there for people. And they're thinking, do I want the expense and the hassle of a lawsuit? Or do I just want to keep walking on eggshells around this person? So to me, it's less an issue of, are they difficult or are they narcissistic? I don't think there's a need to dance on that diagnostic scalpel. I think what's more important is that this person's difficult. Yeah. Nothing is working. Clear communication's not working. They definitely sort of seem somewhat devoid of empathy. They're very, very self-serving. I'm in trouble. And then the techniques that become very much documentation, very clear documentation. The key to dealing with difficult narcissistic people is gatekeeping. You've got to have great front-end kinds of operations. In other words, like contracts are written in a way that you've got the out, that you don't trap yourself in something. Unfortunately, labor law has not been ever, you know, people write labor law don't often think about narcissism. And so mm-hmm. what happens is labor law often does start according people a lot of rights, as it should, but it doesn't account for the very toxic person who hangs in long enough to benefit from those protections and can really make life a literal nightmare for the people who have to live with them. Collaboration becomes important. Like I said, entire careers can get dismantled. Documentation yeah. gets very important. Very realistic expectations become important. Then sometimes if it really escalates, you have to work with an attorney to really figure out what are your rights under the law. And, you know, and it's probably going to cost you money. Attorneys cost money. Lawsuits cost money. So it's not easy. And so part of it is paying attention to it. But I also tell people, make sure you do not fall into sort of the jolly mentality of, oh, well, they're just a little bit of a handful. We'll figure it out. No, you won't. And I can guarantee what's going to happen is if you allow, let's say it's a dental practice and there's two or three dentists there and one of them's really toxic. Mm-hmm. That toxic dentist is going to be the reason you lose your best hygienists. You lose some of your really good technical staff because they're going to say, to heck with this, I could work somewhere else and have it be less stressful. So the idea that we can appease the toxic person and keep them in place is a fool's errand that could really blow up in your face. And on top of that, that toxic dentist can also be very stressful for the patients. And so you may end up losing patients or maybe even harming patients. And so I think that that addressing toxic people in a workplace, and that's why partnership agreements around practices and everything, you have to be very careful. And I tell people, if you're going to go into a very big business kind of a setup with somebody and you sense a red flag, you better take a very big step out because it's a lot easier to get into a partnership than it is to get out.
Okay. All right. Just touching upon then, sometimes we don't always have the liberty to be able to get out of a situation. For example, if it's our boss or a senior colleague and we need the job to be able to, you know, pay for things mm-hmm. at home, rent bills and stuff. Sometimes I know a few dentists that, you know, don't have a great relationship with their boss because their boss is very demanding. I'm not too sure if the definition would be narcissistic or difficult, but to them it's a chore going into work and they aren't enjoying dentistry they used to because of the person they have above them. They can't leave the job because they haven't got a different opportunity yet and they still need the income from it. But they're stuck there in that situation without being able to dismiss the other person. How can they deal with it?
That's a very, very, very difficult situation. And I'll be honest with you, in some ways, you almost can't. There's no straightforward path to winning. I wish I could sit here and say there's a path out of this one. There's no clean path out. The first path, which I call the path of staying, is really one of radical acceptance. This boss is always going to be a tyrant. This is always going to be a difficult job. Realistic expectations that this is the limits of this. I'm not going to wake up one day, show up at work, and this person's going to be nice. Very clear documentation of what you're being asked to do. In some ways, it's sad because it could add another hour and a half to a day where you very carefully document what's going on, because if it ever has to be taken to a legal or other kind of a setting, you need the documentation. So you have to write down everything that's going on, save email, save voicemail, save texts, save minutes of meetings, all of that. You know, make sure that all the, you know, paperwork and everything that is being processed properly. Because as I said, you may need that one day to get out, but you do need to document. Talk to other people in your field. Sometimes when you work with someone tyrannical long enough, you start tricking yourself into thinking, well, maybe this is how it is everywhere. Or you start making justifications for your work setting. Well, I get paid better than other people, or this is a nicer place to work, or it's close to my house. Mm-hmm. This is going to be a bad example, but it's somebody who's in a terrible marriage and doesn't talk to other people about it because they don't want to really know how terrible their marriage is, or they're afraid that they're going to go start talking to other people and realize they want to meet somebody else, kind of thing. But the same thing here is that they might start, if you start talking to colleagues and they'll say, heck, we're making more than you and we work this many fewer hours and we see this many fewer patients, and you might start seeing that there are other opportunities out there. That becomes very, very important, is to see what's out there. What is there another way to do this? to get support, because if you have to stay, it may be helpful to get, okay, how much worse, how much better than is this? If you want to get support from other people, highly advise getting therapy under those situations, because these toxic workplaces can really take a toll on somebody, but it's never going to get better. And I can almost guarantee you that you will see stress-induced medical illness in folks like this, headaches, backaches. Dentistry is already a demanding profession because of the ways you have to stand and bend and all of that. So because of that, you already have musculoskeletal stress. That's going to get compounded by the stress of working with a really toxic boss. And that actually can really, really result in long-term disability and impairment, that even after you retire, you may be paying for those sort of physical aches and pains. And it really diminishes quality of life. Just like you were saying before, oh, I want to be a good husband. I want to be a good parent. Mm-hmm. I don't want to bring my work home. When you have a toxic boss, you may not be quote unquote bringing your work home, but you may be ruminating over it. So you have to be prepared for that too. Some people then say, okay, if I leave, I may end up taking a financial hit. It could be an opportunity cost that may just set you free. So you may almost have to do the math again. So, okay, if I leave this, I might lose this many thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands. However, I see a longer term opportunity on the back end of this. Yes, this was a costly kind of a mess in my life, but then it starts becoming difficult to put a dollar value on a better quality of life. That difficult person is not going to change. Using that as the starting off point, make your decisions accordingly.
Okay, thank you. And on the flip side then, because I'm sure we will have some listeners and readers who probably are the toxic and narcissist person in the workplace there. Mm-hmm. They might not know it themselves, but sometimes I know the difficulties of owning a clinic and being a boss or being a difficult colleague.
Right.
What advice can you give to a narcissistic person to be able to better their relationships with other people?
First of all, they'd have to recognize it, right? So that's the handful that's willing to say, I'm listening to this and this sounds like me. It would be to be mindful. Stop before you talk. Recognizing that a very busy dental practice or any medical practice can lead to people being clipped or sharp or rude, then you want to make reparations as quickly as possible. So if you were very harsh with a clerical staffer or a hygienist or even with a colleague, you want to generate apologies as soon as possible. You want to be able to turn to someone and say, today I took too sharp a tone with you and I genuinely apologize for that. I was under pressure, but that's not an excuse. Show genuine contrition, and contrition's only worthwhile if it results in behavioral change. Show a change in your behavior. Try to catch yourself the next time. Have practice meetings where you focus on things like civility, like make that part of the workplace culture. Check your entitlement. Many, many times people who are very toxic and very difficult are also very entitled, and they expect that the rules don't apply to them, but they apply to everyone else. It really requires a deep dive to say, okay, am I holding myself to a different standard than everybody else? And then adjust that. People, yes, they understand that the boss is going to have maybe more privileges and perks and authority than someone else, but civility can be handed out and should be equal across all levels. And so to catch yourself in that piece as well, I'll be frank with you. Most difficult people don't know they're difficult, or they justify their difficulty. I'm running a busy practice. You expect me to be a nice person when I'm running such a busy practice? Yeah, actually I do. And so, that it's the justifications. Think of the justifications you come up with rather than the contrition. Like I said, you can't keep getting yourself out of messes by apologizing. You can't be a jerk every day and apologize every evening. That's still going to take a toll on your staff. But when you do make a mistake, to apologize for it, to take ownership for it, because that's a big one. Many times difficult and toxic bosses will blame other people. This is your fault for not ordering this. This is your fault for scheduling this. This is your fault for that. Catch yourself, because every time someone else is blamed, there's some shared responsibility. Was it a poor communication on your side? Is your staff overworked? So that kind of an error would be because of people being asked to do too much. Are they not being paid sufficiently? Stop and ask, like, am I asking for something realistic? It's almost like saying to a three-year-old, hey, can you go to the store, drive to the store and buy me some milk? You wouldn't do that because you know they can't do it. Sometimes you're asking your staff to do things that they're not equipped to do, or they're too stretched, too thin to do. So it's about taking responsibility. Like I said, in my experience, difficult and toxic people don't tend to do that.
Okay, thank you. Yeah. But okay. Just before we go on to our final moments, for all of our new dentists or dentists that are looking to go into a new workplace, what are the signs of someone that they're going to be narcissistic or difficult that they should look for in an interview, first meeting someone that they should be mindful of before they get into a situation like that?
I would a couple of things. I would pay attention to how well they listen, how well they pay attention, how aware they are of the things that you're asking about. Like, again, how present are they? I would look at, how do they talk about other people? Are they speaking disparagingly of other dentists? Oh, you're lucky you came to work with me, because that person down there is an idiot. That disparaging kind of disregard for other colleagues, they're going to talk about you that way too. You can guarantee it. And so it shows you that already there's a willingness to sort of engage in relatively uncivil and dismissive conduct. That's going to be another red flag. Another red flag would be, how do they manage stress? Probably in the first week or two in a new position, you would be able to see what's happening on a particularly busy day, or maybe something, an order doesn't come in or something like that. And on that kind of day, watch how that person conducts themselves. Do they start yelling? Do they start throwing a tantrum? If that's a huge red flag, if you see that, because that's going to happen time and time and time again. Do you see someone who seems to sort of play it fast and loose with the rules, saying, yeah, no, I'm going to play with that insurance thing, or I'm going to do this. And it seems like they're doing things that are, feel a little bit shady. Pay attention to that. That kind of unethical conduct could be an issue. Pay attention to somebody who's overly grandiose, who's over-promising things, who is saying things like, I can give you the most dazzling smile for $10. You know, no, they can't. You know, implants cost, cosmetic dentistry costs. You know, the kinds of things that a person can expect after certain dental procedures cost. And so you want to watch what sort of what kinds of promises they're making. And you also want to watch for somebody who might be gouging people, you know, who might be charging enormous sums of money for something and feeling like this is really off base with the rest of dental practice. So in other words, they may have made their office look like a sort of health spa or something like that, with fountains and all this kind of stuff, but they're charging people insane amounts of money. And you know that those services could be delivered still maybe expensively, but not at that level. And it makes you uncomfortable, because that might be sort of a statement on things like grandiosity or something like that. That would be with any health profession. Even in my case, somebody saying, hey, I'll see you for therapy for $2,000. I'd say, that seems like a lot of money for that. So it would be like in any kind of medical profession, I think watching for how people are pricing. And if there's this sort of grandiose idea that I'm offering something so much better because I'm offering, I don't know, some sort of green tea and candles in my lobby, you know, I would say that that might tell you something about sort of the grandiosity. Watch how they conduct themselves on social media. Are they selling themselves as sort of like the glamour dentist, you know, with the sort of, they almost look like a modeling shoot than what you'd expect of a health professional. While I understand that that sometimes happens in the field, it could also be the sort of thing where if it feels so much more about appearance than it does about humane treatment of patients, then that might be a red flag. Another red flag is, how are patients treated? How are they spoken to? Not just by office staff, but when they're in the office. And how are those patients spoken about when they're not there? Are they spoken about in disparaging terms? For example, dismissive things being said about their appearance or some other elements of them, or even worse, discriminatory terminology being used. Pay attention to that. All of those things, you know, any one of those things happening is a red flag, but those things tend to cluster. And if many of them are happening, that's a real sign of patterns that are not likely to change.
Mm-hmm. I've actually taken note of all of that, because there are definitely some key points that I'm going to be more mindful of when I go into my next job interview or enter a new workplace. And I think all of our listeners tuned in, you don't even have to be in the dental industry to understand that those are some points that apply across the whole workforce for everyone. So definitely be more mindful of that. And for my last question to wrap up the podcast, last year in the issue of the journal Vascular Surgery, there was a manuscript entitled Prevalence of Unprofessional Social Media Content Among Young Vascular Surgeons. It was later retracted by the journal's editorial board, but the article sought to identify what the authors considered to be inappropriate and unprofessional behavior on various social media platforms. And this was done in an effort to recognize and in turn and discourage any such behavior which could have any negative impact on patient respect for doctors. While some issues kind of addressed clearly critical for patient care, including
patient privacy violations, slander of colleagues, and illegal drug use. There were a few issues that could be, you know, controversial because they looked into young physicians, especially female physicians' lives, and looked and illustrated pictures of them in bikinis and them living their lives. And, you know, was that really kind of disrespectful towards their patients? Not too sure. But caused a lot of controversy. There was a med bikini hashtag that came out after that where loads of doctors, you know, female and both male, just posted pictures of them in their bikinis and their swimwear and them living their lives. So my question to you is, do you think doctors and dentists should be more mindful of the things that they post on social media, or should we just be free to live our lives and be authentic and true to ourselves and portray that image out?
I think that once you are using social media as a platform for your professional practice, you really need to watch how you conduct yourself in that practice. You'd have to say, if I am showing how I'm on my bikini vacation or on my glamour sitting on the hood of a fancy sports car kind of thing, is that something you really want your patients to see? Is this what you want to communicate to your staff who may not have as many resources as you? And really ask yourself, would you be doing dental practice in your swimsuit? If the answer to that is no, maybe that's not the vision you want to put out. It may be a sign to somebody who wants to work with somebody who's using it as this very grandiose kind of self-serving space, that you'd want to be careful about, is this who I want to work with? I mean, again, this is not a judgment. Listen, people want to do that, and that's getting them patients in the door. I have nothing to say about that. Business is business. I'm saying to somebody who's going to work in that kind of a situation, the way you're valued is likely to be on a much more superficial metric. So you have to ask yourself, is that person who's using sort of this sort of otherworldly influencer style Instagram kind of approach to dentistry, they may be succeeding brilliantly. It's for somebody who's going to work there. Ask if that's going to be a good fit for you.
Definitely. I'm going to be much more mindful of all the stuff I start posting now. Dr. Romani, this has been amazing. I really hope that this episode has been impactful for everyone listening in as much as it has been for me. I'm definitely going to be re-listening to it a few more times. If you want to find out more about Dr. Romani, she has her own YouTube and Instagram channel called Dr. Romani, where you can find such great pearls of wisdom she shares. I hope that this episode has served everyone listening and helps you find the path to your true self and what you really want to do and what you really want to stand for. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'll see you all in the next one.